though I've been looking forward to this chat for a while. Since I first picked up your latest volume, How Now, Brown Frau, Merity Eastman. Merity, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chris.
And you look radiant this morning.
I walked in, actually. That's why.
Now, look, we'll talk about the book in just a moment, but the Tasmanian connection. But I grew up reading Wall's reviews in the Mercury. Yeah. Wall Eastman, of course, the staple of the ABC here.
That's
a long-time ABC servant with the ABC in Canberra. And Wall and Berenice, the fish and chips of theatre in Hobart at every performance.
That's right.
A review every time. So
yes.
I hope Wall and Berenice are listening this morning
as well.
Oh, I'm sure
they are, if they can find the right station.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure they are.
It's probably glued onto the ABC.
Probably, that's right.
Now, was it always because of the theatrical connection that you had an inevitable destiny to be on stage, on screen yourself?
Well, yes. Mum and Dad certainly pushed us towards the arts as kids when we were all growing up in Queensland, actually. But it was also the only thing I was really good at, to be frank, Chris. Academically, my performance wasn't that wonderful. But, you know, put me in front of a group of people and suddenly I would perform. And so I it was pretty clear but when I was about 12, I think, that I had a talent for acting. Not much else,
yes.
But acting.
Yeah,
you know.
And this was, what, seen in school plays?
Or, yes, that's right. Yeah. Firstly in Queensland, and then we moved to Hobart in 1973, and I went to Friends School. And then I joined Apprentice Theatre, which used to run on Saturday afternoons in Hobart. Fantastic organisation.
Was that Diana Large?
Yes, Diana Large.
Yes.
Yeah. And we did all sorts of productions at the Theatre Royal. I got to play Peter Pan at the Theatre Royal and fly.
Crikey. And,
isn't that great?
That would have been one of the very earliest productions of Peter Pan, because the rights to it as a theatrical production didn't come out that long ago.
Oh.
Yeah.
Ooh,
so, probably at the forefront of
perhaps
that.
We broke the law.
Yeah, who knows. So you showed this talent, but... And it was obviously spotted by others as well, because you went to NIDA, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to NIDA. I was pretty determined to go to NIDA, and I auditioned when I was 18 and luckily got in, and then stayed in Sydney for about 10 years after I graduated in 83, and then went to Melbourne for about 10 years. We worked mainly for the Melbourne Theatre Company for 10 years. It was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then went back to Sydney.
Yeah, so your CV shows you as a full-time actress. You weren't...
There's this clearly to have ended up in a brothel working as a receptionist, there was a bit of a
break.
There
is a story to that. We'll come to that in a second.
When I moved from... Yeah, the CV looks fantastic, but when I moved from Melbourne to Sydney in 1999, nothing happened. Mm. And that's when I got that job through Centrelink and ended up writing a book.
Isn't that incredible? And we're talking about there's a bear in there, and I think the subtext was, and he wants Swedish or some such. Yes. Was that when your fair income Centrelink said, would you like a job as a receptionist in a brothel?
It was Job Finder Roy. That's right. Well, actually, he went crimson. He was just, you know, receiving information, and he read this piece of paper and he just blushed. And he said, I don't think you want to see this one. And he was going to put it in the bin, and I said, stop.
So they're all legit, are they, the brothels?
Yes. In Sydney and Melbourne, as far as I know, other cities, I'm not sure which ones, you can have legal brothels.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
So you were there on the payroll being paid legally, et cetera, et cetera.
As a receptionist, let's keep saying that.
Yes, that's right. And accruing good stories. Was there a book in... I mean, the day you sat down, you would have thought, I'm going to write about this.
Well, when I started, I thought, I'll just do this for a few weekends and because I was so curious, and maybe there's some idea for a book or a... Not a book, because I didn't know I could write a book.
Because you hadn't written anything.
No, that's right. I was thinking as an actor, and I was thinking as a one-woman show. And then I stayed and stayed and stayed because I found the girls so interesting, and I became quite fond of a few of them, as you know, if you've read the book. I ended up staying doing weekend shifts for 10 months, and I still thought when I left there to do a sitcom, I still thought it was a one-woman show or some kind of script for an actor. Mm. Then I wrote out my notes and thought, actually, this is sort of reading like a sort of kind of book. Yeah. And I sent it off to three publishers, just, you know, 20 or so pages, and all three got back to me within a week saying that they wanted to publish.
That's right, and you tell a funny story somewhere I've read about sitting in a car because you had like an hour to make a decision and you couldn't.
That's right.
Yeah, there was a bidding war.
There was, and I was working at the Sydney Theatre Company. Yes. I was doing morning Sacrifice by Dimphna Cusack. And I remember I was sitting in the car outside and the pressure was on. It was like decide. It was between Alan and Unwin and Pan Macmillan or Random House. I can't remember. Mm. And I just didn't know because I was such a new
girl. Just take the one that
girl.
Paid the most money?
Well, they were all up. There was a bidding war. So
how exciting.
Oh, boy. Yeah,
but
it was very
exciting. In your first
exciting.
Book, I mean, every author's dream, and you hit the jackpot.
I was so lucky.
Yes.
But let's be honest. The book combined play school presenter with the sex industry, and that doesn't happen too often.
Yes, and that's what maybe we should underline that. Yes.
Yes.
You had obviously done your time on Play School.
That's right. In the late 80s, I did about four or five years on Play School.
That's right. And then it looked like you spent 50 years on Play School because the umpteen thousand repeats of those
particular episodes.
Yes.
That's right. People even today think I'm still on it. Say no.
you were asked to... you didn't have your contract renewed with Play School. You were a bit bittered about that, weren't you?
Well, I went overseas for a year in 1990, I think. And when I came back, there was Trish Goddard and Liz Birch and Monica Trapaga and all these new people on Play School, but still Noni, who I used to, she was in my era. And they weren't asking me back. And I bumped into John Fox, dear old John Fox, who's no longer with us. And he was an executive producer. And I said, John, why didn't you guys ever ask me back? And he said, Meredith, you were lovely on Play School, but your singing voice wasn't the best.
Yes.
It wasn't your strongest talent.
Which irritated you because you thought one of the reasons you'd got the job, because you knew your singing voice probably wasn't the best, but they said you've got a singing voice that everybody can relate to.
That's right. Thank you, Chris. Yes. You've done your research. They did say that when I started.
I had an appalling moment on radio once where I had Jackie Weaver sitting where you are now.
Right.
And something happened in my brain, Jackie Weaver, Noni Hazelhurst, the two are interchangeable. And I started talking about her time on Play School, which she went along with, to her credit.
She's gorgeous.
And then I realised, this sort of moment of horror 2 minutes in that, wrong person. And what else have you done? Other than Play School.
Two incredibly talented Australian actresses.
Yes.
You're not blamed too much for confusing them.
And you're currently on Pack to the Rafters, which is on commercial television.
Yes, that's right. I went to Munich in 2004. We came back in 2009. And last year, I started Pack to the Rafters, playing Donna, another nervous idiot sort of... My long career of playing nervous idiots. It's true. It's true. I could show you the photos through the scrapbook.
Oh, dear. If you'd like a quick word to Merity, we won't take thousands of calls, but we want to quickly catch up with you. You can give us a call, 1300 222 936, or send the text on 0438 922 936. Merity Eastman in my studio. Yes. And now to the reason you're here.
Yep.
You mentioned you returned from Munich in 2004, whatever it was.
Yes.
You married, you when you were on a promotional tour for There's a Bear in There, you were in the UK, and you came across a German fellow on a pier at Lymington or
That's
such.
Right.
Wasn't that the story?
Yes.
And one thing led to another, and you found yourself marrying him, moving to Bavaria, pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Can I mention your age again? I already have done one, so it makes no difference, does
41.
It? You were 41.
Yes.
And you moved to Bavaria, a very conservative village. It sounds like south of Munich, yes?
Well, it's Munich. It's Munich. And we used to holiday in the village south of Munich at the family's holiday home.
Yes.
But I was living in Munich at the time,
Without a word of German.
Yes.
And the Bavarian dialect even gets subtitled in some mainstream German television stations.
I cannot understand it. When they start speaking Bayerisch, I'm lost. And I can speak a little German now, so...
Yes.
Yeah.
But you couldn't then. And that's why the book's so funny. And can I say, Meredith, it is beautifully written. I mean,
it really is.
It is genuinely very, very funny.
Thank you. It's not,
let's have a laugh at the Germans, because that's very easy if you're a stranger there.
No, it's let's have a laugh at Meredy with the Germans, trying to understand the Germans, trying to survive in Germany.
Did you have not a word of German when you moved there?
Kindergarten, Auf Wiedersehen, Zeitgeist, maybe a few more.
Yes.
So really, I spoke no German at all. And I was really thrown in the deep end because my brother-in-law, Tom's sister's husband, he said to me, I was only there 5 days, and he said to me that I should only be spoken to in German, as it would help. Mm. This is the way to learn German. And this was the attitude of a lot of people, certainly Tom's family.
Yes. And you came across a woman who was actually a lecturer at the Goethe Institute, which is the big educational thing, who would not talk to you in English, even though she was obviously fluent.
Clearly, yeah, that's right. No, it was this, it's very Germanic, I've got to say. This thing, you know, this is good for you and this will work. And, you know, bless them. They're quite often right, but it's just the German way. And look, I did learn German in a class finally in Linguasprachschule in the city, and we only spoke German. That was the rule as soon as we walked in the door. But we had a teacher who, you know, took us gently from scratch through the grammar, the minefield of grammar you have to learn. Mm. 16, I think, ways to say the. And so after 6 months with her, I was you know, doing okay. And 2 years later, I was able to have conversations.
Yes, which must have been to realise all of a sudden I've well, not mastered, but I can partake in a German conversation. Must have been very rewarding.
Yes, it was great. It was a wonderful feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes people thought I was much more fluent than I was, and they'd start to, you know, really go off on a story, and I just panicked.
Because there's all that assumption, isn't there, that everywhere you go, somebody will speak English, which they might have done. But they didn't.
They didn't. Yes. Yeah, everyone said to me before I went to Munich, everyone said, oh, you'll love it, and the Germans love to speak English. Everyone will speak English with you. Well, that's just not true, everyone.
Yeah.
Especially when you're in hospital giving birth to your baby. No one spoke English to me, and then I really would have appreciated it because at that stage I didn't speak any German
and
either.
You do make that episode funny, but it can't have been funny. It must have been terrifying because there's cultural nuances about the whole sort of process of birthing that are so different to Australia. I mean, you talked about the suffering, you know, is good for you aspect of it.
And the pethidine, the absence of, you know, I mean, they give you a little bit. I had a caesarean, I should just say. Mm. And when I woke up from the operation, I was in quite a bit of pain, but I understood from, you know, what people told me that the Germans don't administer pethidine as freely as we do in Australia.
It toughens you up.
Yes.
You're very funny in your observations, though, about how, again, it's the cultural difference, isn't it? Tom took over your, just the general looking after you.
Yes.
He
had to do everything.
Yes.
You know, health insurance, you know, organising our wedding day, everything.
Buying shoes for you that fitted, getting the surgical support stock for you.
The Schutzstrumpfhose. Oh, dear. Yeah, look, things got pretty bad, I must admit, when I was in the later stages of the pregnancy and giving birth because of the language barrier. And at the time, I was not laughing. But this is the funny thing about being a humorist or whatever it is I am. I think the worse the experience, the funnier I find I can make it in hindsight.
Mm.
And it's always only in hindsight. It's always looking back on it, you know, afterwards.
Yes.
Which I guess a lot of us do.
Yes. I suspect there's one time when there was a family gathering, you took yourself off to your room and were weeping on the bed, thinking about, you know, I just feel so of
what
much of
an am
ass.
I doing here?
Yes, yes. Which you turn into a funny episode. But at the time, it wouldn't have been funny.
No, that's right. Yeah. That's right, Chris. It wasn't funny at the time.
Yes.
But it's very funny in the book.
Yes.
I hope.
Yes. And now, look, I've got to confess, I did a little bit of time in Vienna working for Austrian radio. And so maybe the book resonates with me just slightly more than perhaps some who haven't spent time there. But what you talk about with, well, the obsession with punctuality, well, as epitomised by the public transport for a start.
Oh, incredible.
Yeah. I mean, the Viennese tram, underground railway, bus, train, overground train system.
That was punctual too.
It's just the eighth wonder of the world.
Yeah. It's incredible, isn't it?
Extraordinary. But the how you use it is the part that you make those observations. It's very funny.
And the contrôleur, the people that come on the public transport system to check your ticket because they've got an honour system there. You know, when you first arrive there, it seems to an Australian that you can just travel around the public transport system free. But if you don't have that ticket on you and the contrôleur come on, oh, my God, it's the most humiliating experience.
Yes.
And it happened to me once, which is in the book.
You're actually caught.
Yes.
Goodness gracious.
And they're in plain clothes.
Yes.
And that you don't know what they're going to look like or how old they'll be. And these were three women, sort of, you know, grey hair, not what I was expecting, or wearing floral dresses and cardigans, who then whipped out their badges and went through the whole carriage saying, you know,
Fahrkarte.
Ja, genau. Ja, genau. Fahrkarte bitte, it was. And I didn't have mine because Tom had borrowed it.
Yes.
And it was one of the worst days of my life in Munich.
I used to work with a fellow on with the radio station news team who used to burst into tears whenever they came on. He was so terrified.
Well, there you go. They are terrifying. And it's because everyone has bought their ticket. Everyone obeys. That's right. Everyone...
The Austrian theory is they will provide public transport that will be on the minute, mm-hmm. every 3 minutes, 24, well, it's not 24 hours a day, but, you know, within you know, normal travel times.
Yeah.
And it will be there on time, and it's only going to be a dollar a day.
Yes.
And if you use it, fabulous. If you don't, we'll find the life out of you.
Yes.
And you
they do.
Yeah.
And when they do it in that public way.
Yes.
And, you know, everyone is looking at you. It's the only time everyone will look at you.
You talked about just how, and we have to say, miserable you came across this bevy of dermatic older women. But when they, back to my story, very briefly, on the trams, when they used to find the people who were always the Gastarbeiter, the foreign workers who were there, and they would get them in the middle of the tram in a little huddle, and they would be hissed at by people sitting at...
Oh, that's terrible. That's worse than Munich.
And then they'd all be taken off the tram in a gaggle and fined.
That's shocking.
It was awful.
Oh,
dear. It was just dreadful. Yes.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. But you did experience there was a... and it
the
did seem to be
ladies.
The little old lady stereotype.
Look, I had to write about it, and I feel bad about this, but I asked a lot of expats, and I even spoke to my husband, Tom, and his friend, Alex, and that's in the book, a conversation I had with them, about the elderly women that I excuse me, came across in Munich who had a way of coming across a little bit cross and, you know, telling you to pick up rubbish and pushing in front of you to get onto the crowded train and so on. And when I had Henry, when Henry was a baby in his pram, they wouldn't hesitate to come up and tell me, you know, das Kind hat Hunger, or kalte Füße, if he had cold feet, or you know, if they decided that that's what he had. And I used to talk to other people about this and say, you know, is it my imagination or are the little old ladies here a little bit cranky? And it was explained to me that this was a generation who had, of course, lived through the war. And the women in particular had it tough. They lost everything. They lost quite often husbands, brothers, sons. They were often the Trümmelfrauen, they used to call them, the rubble women who were conscripted to put together... put the city back together after the raids. They were Trümmelfrauen means rubble women, and they had to clean up the city.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
From the age of 16 to whatever.
And you had an interest, didn't you, in the legacy of the Second World War and how particularly it affected Munich too?
Yeah,
it was one of your. And some of the sites that you point out, where there's still some eagles carved in stone, which haven't actually been removed.
I don't know why that one hasn't been removed. Mm. It's the only one.
Because it's illegal to display the swastika, of course, in both Austria and Germany these days.
That's right.
And you, in fact, got caught up in a neo-Nazi demonstration. But what was the interesting part about that, and I won't tell the story for you, is that the opposition that had was far more... frightening, if you like, than the actual demonstration itself. Yeah.
Yeah, well, since Hitler, they allow freedom of speech.
Mm. Which is what the war was fought for, I suppose.
Exactly, exactly. And the Germans are incredibly, you know, strong on this democratic right. And that means that the neo-Nazis as well are allowed to demonstrate as long as they seek permission from the city. Mm. And then it's announced. And so everyone knows that on Saturday and this date there will be a neo-Nazi demonstration. And what happens then is fantastic. And that is that the counter-demonstrators come out in throngs and they vastly outnumber the neo-Nazis every single time. And I witnessed this demonstration, which I shouldn't have hung around for quite so long because I was quite heavily pregnant, but there were, you know, I found myself in the middle of it and there were 500 or so neo-Nazis demonstrating and police everywhere. It was all under control, in Ordnung, as you would expect, but there were about 5,000 counter-demonstrators there just shouting at the neo-Nazis. And it was quite moving, actually.
I felt
really proud of Germans. I just thought, you know, I can see and feel what you've been through and how strongly you feel about this. And, you know, it's quite extraordinary.
Yes.
I wanted to write about that as soon as I got home.
Isn't that terrific?
Yeah.
And so there is a part of you that, because you talk about the World Cup was on all the time too.
Oh, I'm German.
Exactly. I mean, who do you support? You know?
I do support the German team. I did, by the time I left Germany in, you know, 2009, I was barracking for the German team because I'd been there through the 2006 World Cup. But I was German just because I had integrated it so much more and got to understand so many more things, which you do.
Now you're living in Sydney, aren't you? Which is a beautiful beautiful city. But yes. There are times when you just thank the Lord you'd ended up in Munich because you too thought that was such a beautiful place to be
That's
living.
That's right. Yeah. It's my second time and it always will be. And Tom and I will always go back there. I should tell the listeners that Tom's with me.
Yes.
I dragged him back with me. And Henry, our boy, is with us too, of course.
Who is multilingual, I assume.
Yeah, well, bilingual.
Yes, at least. Yes.
Yes, zweisprachiger.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
Merrily, we're going to have to press on because we're out of time. How Now Brown Frau was launched last Friday in Hobart. It's lovely that you keep the Tasmanian connection.
I always will. I love coming home.
Because there's Bear in there and the other volume, Ridiculous Expectations, were international sellers. I mean, just talk about There's Bear in There.
There's a Bear in There has been sold in the UK and Germany as well as New Zealand and Australia and was a bestseller in Australia. And Ridiculous Expectations and this one so far just in Australia and New Zealand, but let's hope for an international
it's got to be published in Germany for doesn't it?
It was the first.
It's a bit of a year in Provence in a way, but you know, it's the German side.
Yeah. I've got a German publisher in Germany, so I should go back to them with that.
And they're not offended by what you say.
Hopefully not.
Just hope that humour translates.
Yeah.
Because they might not think it's funny.
They have a wonderful sense of humour, but it's just a different sense of humour to ours. So, yeah, let's see. I'll let you know, Chris.
Merrily Eastman, lovely catching up with you. It's available now, and the good news is it's actually available through ABC shops as well. How did you make that connection?
I don't know. I just walked in there yesterday, and there they were.
Brilliant stuff.
Excellent.
How Now, Brown Frau, by Merrily Eastman, my studio guest. I wish you'd worn your dirndl, the traditional costume.
I'm on the cover there. I'll wear it next time, okay?
You look fantastic. Fantastic. Merrily, nice to catch up. I was looking forward to this chat this morning. Thank you.
Me too.